We continue to refer to another Wahhabi scholar, the founder of Wahhabi school of thought, Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab. He has a book which is called Risalatun ala Radd al-Rafida, a book on rejecting the Shia, who he named as Rafida. His claim is also interesting. The bigger the lie is, maybe,
the more you attract the audiences. Exactly. Yeah. That's a media trick, basically.
You know that one of the differences of the between the Shia and the Sunnis is that whether we are allowed to say Zuhr and Asr prayer together, I mean, one after the other, without any gap of time, or not. According to the Shia, we are recommended to say the prayers in five different times, but we are allowed to Zuhr and Asr and Maghrib and Isha. Now, this Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab claims that the reason that the Shia say the Zuhr and Asr prayers together is that he related it to the story of Sardab. He says that.
Really?
Yeah. They are waiting for their Qa'im in Sardab, and they are waiting for him to come so that they say the congregational prayer with him. So why they say Zuhr and Asr prayer together? Because they do not say the Zuhr prayer on time. They delay it up until the time that is close to the sunset. So Mahdi is not coming. They become disappointed. So they say Zuhr and Asr prayer together at the end of the time.
And that to end of the time.
End
I mean, this
time.
This one is interesting.
Yeah, this one is a new lie, I mean, in this regard. Because they are waiting for Mahdi to come, they say that we prefer not to say the Zuhr prayer. We wait. Maybe Imam Mahdi will come out of the Sardab so we can say the Zuhr and ask prayer with him. So then it's about sunset. So that is why they say Zuhr and ask prayer together, one after the other. And this is the reason that this is the viewpoint of the Shia regarding the jurisprudence. And then it is sunset. They become disappointed after saying Zuhr and ask prayer. This part is very strange. He says that then they call and they make a sound like the sound of a rooster. And then say those two rak'ah together without any khushu', without any tuma'nina, without any presence of the heart. And furada min ghayra jama'ah, this is very strange how they have come with all these details. They say this prayer without any presence of the heart and mind. They say it individually, not in congregation. They go back to their houses while they are disappointed. And then he asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that nas'alullah al-'afwa wal-'afya, please forgive and pardon these misguided people. And
Of course, he's praying for himself at the end.
Exactly. So this is quoted in Risala fi Radd ala Rafida, volume 1, page 33. Now, is it only about the Wahhabi scholars in the past? So this Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab passed away in 1206 after Hijra, about 250 years ago. So it's still up until that time. I mean, he didn't try to just check one of the Shia sources to see even if one Shia scholar has ever mentioned this.
Or who Shia offers prayers at the end of the day.
Exactly.
I mean, we have so many narrations saying that if you have any problems of if you want the blessings of Allah, or if you have want a key to success or in any of the issues, you should go for prayers on time, on time. I don't know. I have never heard this before. Like, you know, you are basically offering prayers at the end of the day.
So, this is a so-called scholar who passed away in 1206. Let's go to some of the contemporary Wahhabi or maybe Sunni scholars. I mean, it makes it more strange because in our time, we expect all the Muslim scholars to check everything with the genuine sources.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
the scholars you mentioned right now were some 200 to 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And even if they said that, they had no access to, you know, say, internet information. But today, you can do, you know, live debates with scholars of other religions. You can study contemporary religion. I mean, everything is at your hands. And still, there are claims. So I would definitely want to know what are the contemporary claims.
Yeah, let me refer to one of the contemporary Wahhabi scholars in our time, Abdullah Al-Qamisi. He has a book called As-Sira' Bain al-Islam wal-Wataniyya in volume 1, page 374. He is, of course, too impolite. Sorry for translating his words. The most stupid of the people, the most foolish of the people, are the one who made their imams hidden in Sardab, referring to the Shia.
Oh.
And they are the ones who every night they come to this Sardab together with their horses. They believe that their imam is hidden there. They are waiting for him and they call him to come out, to reappear. The weird point is that this is repeating for about 1,000 years up until today. So come on, man. I mean,
okay. You're living in a contemporary world.
So
and
you can check it.
And if you want to say something, world needs proof.
Exactly.
You can at least upload one of the videos and then claim something. Like you're throwing things in the air.
And not only him, we can mention another Wahhabi scholar, Mustafa Hilmi in Nizam al-Khilafah, page 267, and some other ones which I'm not going to mention. For example, when I told the story for you, I think you also get surprised that is there any Shia to have ever believed that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was hidden there and he
exactly.
will... I mean, at the beginning of this session, you said that we all heard that he will reappear from the Kaaba.
Reappear from the Kaaba, yeah.
So even no Shia has heard about that. So with all these narrations, how can one claim that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam disappeared there and will reappear there? Inshallah, I will refer to some narration in this regard in the following session.
Definitely, we would want to know where the Imam disappeared and where will he reappear, although we have a lot of narrations also in Sunni school of thought, also in Shia school of thought, that Imam is going to reappear from Kaaba, but where from he disappeared, and more narrations about his disappearance and reappearance. We'll talk on them in next session. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. This was Last Savior, and this is your humble host, Zainab, saying goodbye. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The working conditions at American giant retail company Amazon have been subject to a myriad of complaints by the employees. Complaints initially gained national and international attention because of the too few bathroom breaks inhumanely imposed on Amazon staff and drivers in an attempt to maximize productivity and speedy delivery of goods to customers. It was indeed a blatant attempt to boost profits for the owners of the company, most notably its owner and executive chairman, Jeff Bezos, one of the richest men in the world, whose net worth has now exceeded $180 billion U.S. dollars.
Amazon Labor Union.
Hello and welcome to We the People, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in today's episode, we'll investigate the working conditions for the average worker at Amazon, which is reported to be often tough and occasionally unsafe. While Amazon shareholders and customers are mostly happy with the retail giant, the workers, such as those in the warehouses, often have a very different experience. For years, the workers have been making effort to improve the situation, but have not managed to bring about any real change as Amazon keeps suppressing any voices of dissent via its powerful means of crackdown. In today's episode, we'll be joined by Lauren Steiner with a robust opposition to delve deeper into the issue and what could be done about it. And later, we'll be joined by Eric Ramos, union iron worker, mutual aid organizer, and member of the Communist Party USA from Chicago. Stay with us.
Workers in warehouses are tracked with a computer algorithm rather than being reported or written up by any superintendents. Therefore, they get no chance to do anything challenging to the system and are basically expected to perform like robots. Amazon has continued to track every minute of most warehouse workers' shifts, from how fast they pack merchandise to how long they pause.
Now, many have drawn attention to the highly questionable way that Amazon's computerized system hires, monitors, and fires workers based on performance at the service of profit, rendering a cruel juggernaut with no mercy or understanding of real human needs. So is Amazon capitalizing on its workforce to make increasingly greater profits by pressuring employees through measures such as cutting their break times?
Well, I first learned about unfair conditions Amazon warehouses when I lived in Los Angeles. Many of them were not properly cooled and workers were collapsing from heat exhaustion. The other thing that was famously reported is that they have so much that they have to produce. They don't have time to take bathroom breaks and they were peeing in bottles. I know Chris Smalls started his walkout because they during the pandemic, they weren't following proper safety procedures. There was not enough PPE, hand sanitizers. They weren't doing proper social distancing. A lot of service workers, restaurant workers, for instance, the Starbucks workers, they don't get regular hours. They keep them below 30 hours a week, and they don't give them the schedule until a couple of days before the week begins, so they can't, you know, even get a second job.
The already dire conditions has worsened with the breakout of the coronavirus pandemic, which has made more and more Americans rely on the retail delivery service and consequently leading to a bigger workload for the warehouse workers and truck drivers. The employment machine has had to work increasingly harder, which has made the working conditions even more arduous.
Well, I think the workers need to, you know, start unions, which is what they're doing right now. I mean, that's really all they can do. I mean, people have complained to management before with no success. So starting a union is something that forces management to have to listen to them.
Now, as more residents have to rely on online shopping today, in part over fears of shopping in person, Amazon and its founder Jeff Bezos have used its complex and technologically advanced systems to assure the happiness of customers on the one side and to maximize profits for the corporation on the other. So is that going to change with the latest effort by workers in Staten Island? And how could the latest quest by Amazon employees to unionize be assessed?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, when you hear from people on the ground, it was a big factor to them that basically this was an effort that was done by the workers themselves. You know, it was a big choice for them to start their own independent union, opposed to trying to gain representation through established unions. You know, for them, that meant that, I mean, it's a lot easier to trust them. It dismantles the rhetoric from corporations and especially the campaign that Amazon was running that basically says that unions are a third party entity that get between the workers and the bosses, and that their goal is to, you know, gather as many members as possible to you know, basically just to get more dues, you know, so that the union itself can become richer.
Amazon's numerical understanding of the real people has led to unprecedented human suffering, which cannot be represented in numbers. With the sharp spike in demands due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the company has touted breathtaking job creation numbers, and from July to October 2020 alone, it managed to hire up 350,000 new workers.
Now, most of the Amazon workers are hired through computer screening and with no or little conversation with an interviewer. Now, it should come as no big surprise that the working conditions are very similar. What is next for the employees' efforts to make working conditions any better?
Well, I think that it's, as I said in the answer to the first question, I think that Amazon's success is going to be very inspirational. Chris Smalls said in a press conference the other day that 100 different Amazon stores have contacted him about, you know, starting unionization efforts. He's going to be on my show again. And I'm going to have on the people in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where I live now. I live in North Carolina because they're trying to unionize their place of work. So I think it's just going to be a big multiplier.
Now, the bathroom breaks were just a tipping point of the dire working conditions at Amazon. And soon a trove of evidence and complaints appeared on U.S. news and media outlets involving just how workers' rights are being violated by the American multinational tech company.
So I think one of the biggest things to talk about is this thing called TOT. It means time off pay. So basically, all the employees are closely monitored to determine like how much time is spent not doing their assigned tasks. This doesn't mean like it's not just like talking to each other. It's not just checking your phone. It's I'm going to the bathroom or going to get a drink of water. And if this time builds up, they can actually be fired for it for having built up enough time off tasks.
Just recently, Amazon workers at the Staten Island facility voted by a wide margin to form a union, despite all the pressure imposed on them by the men on top. The measure has been described as a revolution at the company, which has so far spared no efforts to crack down on the smallest of attempts by the workers to unionize. Generally speaking, what are the issues workers in big companies such as Amazon are facing, and what should be done to address those issues?
We have this thing in this country where so many workers are like the workers there who are basically getting a minimum wage rates. And, you know, most workers don't want to organize because they're afraid they'll just get fired. Or if they put in a lot of time in a company, you know, it hurts. They don't necessarily want to leave, but a lot of the time they'll just be like, well, it pays the same at other places. So they'll just quit their job somewhere else. And I think that more and more workers are starting to see that, you know, that's just a problem, that conditions are going to be the same everywhere you go. So fortunately, we've seen, you know, I think that a lot of workers are going to be inspired by the ALU, the Amazon Labor Union, and see that, you know, it can be done. And I mean, hopefully we're not just going to see more Amazon warehouses start to organize in the same way, but also across industries just like it, you know.
Now, the company, which focuses on e-commerce, cloud computing, digital streaming, and artificial intelligence, among other things, is just one of many corporations in America which seeks to gain as much as profit as possible, even if it means imposing ever-grueling regulations on its workers. Now, the workers are naturally from the working class and struggle to survive in the capitalistic economy of America.
These different sectors are being used against each other. As far as for, you know, workers in general, everyone feels the squeeze, like I said. Everyone is expected to work longer hours for less pay and less benefits. You know, they're seeing that their money is not going as far as it once year after year when they are getting raises. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy. It's like a, it's almost like it's reminiscent of how it was 100 years ago in the previous American labor movement, you know. People working longer hours for less pay, and people are finally getting sick of it, you know. Yeah.
For years, the American workers have been striving to raise the minimum wage, yet mostly to no avail. Currently, the federal minimum wage for covered non-exempt employees is $7.25 per hour, which many workers deem to be way below what they need to cover the expenses of their livelihood. For long, American workers have been demanding a higher minimum wage. But are those demands going to materialize?
Well, the minimum wage hasn't been raised in many years. And in California, it was raised a few years ago to $15 an hour. And it was done gradually. So only now in 2022 did it become $15 an hour. But of course, in California, $15 an hour is too low of a minimum wage. It's not even a living wage. And here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live, you know, the state minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And they've determined that the living wage in Asheville here is $17.70 an hour. So, and this is a smaller city. This is not Los Angeles or New York. And they don't have unions here. It's a right-to-work state.
Meanwhile, Jeff Bezos has said that he is proud of the company's work culture, productivity goals, as well as the pay and benefits. He is not alone. The work culture in America's huge corporations is designed by the wealthy 1% owners to make sure that they can make more and more money at the cost of ruining everyone else's lives.
My son works these minimum wage jobs. The last employer he had, if they weren't busy, they would send him home, and of course they wouldn't pay him for these hours. So this is what they call precarity. It's a very precarious workplace, and they don't have a lot of rights. Now, you know, in the 50s, 30% of the American workforce was unionized. Now it's just 10%, and 6% of private employers' workforce is unionized. So they just don't have a lot of power. And that creates, that's one of the major causes for income inequality in this country.
So the men in power, they seek to provide as little wages and protection as possible and put the company's goals way above their workers' livelihoods. That has created fewer reliable jobs, more temporary work arrangements, declining wages, and ever-increasing high-stress conditions for the working class in the United States.
The thing is that, you know, real wage is a number in economics used to kind of measure how much wages, you know, how much buying power generally wages have. And that's a number we've seen constantly decreasing over the decades and remaining stagnant. Even though some places have been able to increase their wages, you know, we see that corporations continue to impose higher prices on society in general, which continues to raise the cost of living for everyone. Even people like myself who work in unions, and, you know, unions are often able to negotiate a 3% increase in wages to keep up with this. It hasn't been enough either.
It's not easy to keep working at Amazon, so workers keep quitting their jobs due to the impossible demands from the corporation's algorithm, with a turnover among the workforce roughly standing at 150% a year. Capitalizing on the workforce to make increasingly greater profits is not a novel phenomenon in America. Indeed, many experts believe that is what America and capitalism in general have been founded upon.
There was the PRO Act, which was a very important bill that was introduced last year that was passed by the House. And of course, the Senate won't pass it because, you know, it wouldn't, even if it got all Democrats voting for it, it wouldn't survive the filibuster. And the PRO Act would have outlawed anti-union meetings. It would enact federal financial penalties for threatening or firing workers, and it would help wrongfully terminated workers win reinstatement. So while that PRO Act did not pass, the National Labor Relations Board just issued a memo saying that that companies can't have these anti-union meetings.
Some experts believe that the quality of life is increasingly lowering, and biggest issue facing the American economy and political system is a gradual descent of the middle class into proletarian status. Now, since the 1970s, this process has been going on intermittently and has worsened considerably in recent years.
Our government is essentially, you know, bought by these corporations. The only thing that's ever really been effective is workers organizing in this way. And, you know, it's great to see that it's finally happening. I think we're seeing a resurgence of the labor movements here. I think they're going to have to do what's always worked, which is, you know, organizing and starting these unionization efforts and hopefully building across different lines of the entire American workforce to ultimately, I think that they'll have to build a political arm that actually represents them, that can actually enact a lot of the changes necessary to maintain the gains that they've made.
The way workers are treated in the U.S. keeps on increasing the inequality and injustice running rampant in the country. Enormous wealth is delivered to top executives and shareholders, while little is left for the people at the bottom. The dehumanizing manner in which Amazon conducts its business is spreading among other corporations, which would in part demand dangerously high production quotas likewise.
As long as the goalposts continue to get moved, as far as wages are concerned, you know, it's not gonna matter enough. It's not gonna be enough. What I think is gonna happen is that, you know, workers will succeed in getting wages increased, but we're likely gonna see the cost of living skyrocket in response. And I think that after that, you know, workers are gonna continue to see this. The facade of inflation is going to continue to thin. And they'll kind of realize that, once again, a political arm is going to be necessary for the labor movement in order to ensure that, you know, to ensure greater buying power.
In order to survive in the job market and to keep making ends meet, employees have to push harder to hit impracticable levels. They have to work harder and harder because they feel they're falling down on the job, as the demands by their employers are purposely designed to be unattainable for most workers. So whether or not efforts to unionize are going to change the situation for the better is yet to be seen. Now let's see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us this week.
Huge victory happened for workers at the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, New York, when the workers voted to unionize. It's arguably one of the biggest labor union victories in modern history. But what does this mean? What does it mean for the masses of workers? And what does it mean for the labor movement? On this episode of Power to the People, we will take a look at this recent labor victory and dive into what it means for workers' rights all across the world. But before we talk about this labor union victory, it's important that we look at some of Amazon's notorious inhumane work practices, whether it be wage theft, dangerous workplace conditions during the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to over 20,000 plus cases that we know of, as we know that Amazon was revealed to concealing the number of cases around workers testing positive. But not only that, Amazon has used mass surveillance on employees to make sure that they are working fast, and also have forced delivery drivers to have 14-hour days and no bathroom breaks. The list of inhumane practices go on and on, and we can literally do a whole segment on Amazon's inhumane practices. And these practices, they have made Jeff Bezos the second richest man in the world. Literally, while Jeff Bezos is on his yacht or taking excursions to space, workers are being exploited and being forced to pee in bottles because their work break isn't enough. This exploitation has led to attempts at unions to be founded throughout the country. And the first one to be successful is the establishment of the Amazon Labor Union, which was led by Chris Smalls, who used to work for Amazon, but he was fired as he led a protest against Amazon for the lack of COVID-19 safety measures in the warehouse. Smalls began organizing, and over a year after being fired, he successfully launched a campaign to unionize his former workplace. As the union had captured 2,654 votes, while 2,131 votes were against it. The chickens truly came home to roost for Amazon and Jeff Bezos. And this undoubtedly, it's a historic win. Workers' rights at the warehouse should immediately improve, and it is a huge positive step for people working at that specific warehouse. But what is the full scope of the impact? Well, we are already seeing this victory being co-opted by the state. Bernie Sanders, a liberal Zionist, has been invited to speak with Chris Smalls, which in many ways exposes the lack of strong revolutionary ideology behind the movement. And this is something that workers' unions, they must address, which is a lack of revolutionary ideology. As we see a warehouse and Amazon unionizing, as well as we see a Starbucks shop unionizing, it might create a ripple effect amongst corporate workplaces throughout the world. And this will undoubtedly, it will undoubtedly improve American workers' conditions. But what does this mean for workers and colonized people across the world? These corporations aren't just here in America. They are global corporations and are a part of international finance capital that has been developed through imperialism. So while workers in America begin getting more rights and a welfare state under capitalism is expanded, these corporations, what is they gonna do? They just gonna extend their exploitation overseas and begin exploiting colonized people more than they already are to make up for the money lost due to unionization and workers getting more rights here in America. This is why it's important for workers' unions to have a revolutionary ideology. Workers' unions must fundamentally be anti-capitalist as well as anti-imperialist and must seek to end this parasitic system known as capitalism. Because what is an improvement? What is an improvement in working conditions here in America if we know that this American capitalist is going to go overseas to exploit other colonized people working in factories? And this is part of the evils of imperialism, and it's part of the evils of capitalism. And this is why unions must develop revolutionary internationalist stances that don't just focus on American workers. And throughout history, we've seen examples, whether it's the ILWU not allowing cargo from apartheid South Africa, as well as the ILWU not allowing cargo from Zionist Israel. We must understand that international solidarity is a must, and unions must develop international solidarity. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist Regime Doubles Down on Apartheid. Here's more on this issue. The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians, while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Recently, the Zionist regime reinstated a ban on Palestinian family unification as part of its demographic engineering efforts to ensure a Jewish majority in the territory of historic Palestine. Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, said that the legislation is one of the most racist and discriminatory laws in the world and must immediately be repealed. The Citizenship and Entry into Israel order prohibits the Zionist regime's interior minister from granting residency or citizenship to Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who marry citizens of the occupied territories. According to Adala, which will challenge the law at the Zionist regime's high court, it also bans unification between a citizen or resident of Palestinian territories with spouses from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Adala added that UN human rights bodies have called on the Zionist regime to revoke the ban on Palestinian family unification as it violates the international law. The Zionist regime's parliament, the Knesset, has renewed the temporary order banning family unification 21 times over the past 18 years, the rights group added. However, unlike in the past, the current version of the law explicitly states that its purpose is to ensure a Jewish demographic majority, Adala added. The Zionist regime lawmakers and Ayelet Shaked, the regime's interior minister, has said the legislation is intended to prevent Palestinians from gradually returning to their homeland. Demographic engineering is also informing the Zionist regime's policy on refugees fleeing the violence. Recently, Shaked said that the influx of mostly non-Jewish Ukrainians fleeing to the occupied territories cannot go on. Shaked added, "Anyone with a brain understand that we can't continue at this rate of entry." The Zionist regime's obsession with demographics is nothing new. It has prevented millions of Palestinian refugees and their descendants from exercising the right to return to lands from which they were forcibly displaced on the basis that they are not Jewish. Shaked acknowledged the apartheid nature of the family unification law by tweeting that its approval was a victory for a Jewish and demographic regime and a loss for a regime of all its citizens. The Zionist regime's law, passed in 2018, stipulates that the right to exercise self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Stateless Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza face similar restrictions, with the Zionist regime refusing to confer residency status to foreign nationals who are married to Palestinians living in those territories. Jewish settlers face no such restrictions. Amnesty International highlights the Zionist regime's denial of nationality, residence, and family life in its recent report, finding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians. The suspension of family unification procedures in the West Bank and Gaza affects tens of thousands of foreign nationals married to Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime prohibits Palestinians in Gaza from residing in the West Bank. The human rights group Al-Haq has stated that Palestinians are forced to make life choices as personal as who they marry and where they live based on the constraints of the Zionist regime policies and practices that not only target them but are ultimately aimed at their transfer. Since its inception, the Zionist regime has prevented Palestinians from living in their homeland through the mass expulsions and displacements in 1948 and 1967 and permanently cancelling the residency status of Palestinians in the West Bank, including Al-Quds. As a result of those efforts, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were born in Palestine are now considered foreigners with no immediate right of entry or stay by the Zionist regime, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime also prevents Palestinians living under military occupation from exercising freedom of movement, imposing arbitrary travel bans on more than 10,500 Palestinians in the West Bank last year. The Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported recently that the Zionist regime will vet any foreign lecturers wishing to teach at Palestinian universities in the West Bank. Universities will be able to employ lecturers from abroad only if they teach in fields that have been designated as essential by the Zionist regime. The prospective lecturers must hold a doctorate and will have to submit applications for such permits at the Zionist regime consulate in the applicant's country of origin. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Zionist regime's military occupation, will ultimately approve any entry of a lecturer. That body exercises control over the movement of people and goods in and out of Gaza, including medical patients seeking care, not available in the besieged territory, whose life-saving treatment is frequently denied or delayed. From September 2020 to March 2021, the Zionist regime denied or delayed the travel applications of one-third of all Gaza patients seeking medical treatment in the occupied territories and the West Bank. Applicants seeking to teach at Palestinian universities will have to prove to the Zionist regime's satisfaction that they will make a significant contribution to academic education, to the regional economy, or to the promotion of regional cooperation and peace. The Zionist regime defines virtually anyone who criticizes it or advocates for Palestinian rights to be against peace. This means that the Zionist regime will in effect be imposing total political control over Palestinian universities. According to Haaretz, the number of lecturers will be limited by a quota to be determined by Israel, which currently stands at 100. Meanwhile, only 150 foreign students will be allowed to study at Palestinian universities per year, and COGAT will determine the fields of study open to them. The new restrictions, expected to be implemented in May, have spurred renewed calls for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, many of which have deep ties to the Zionist regime, occupation, apartheid, and settler colonization in Palestine.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
A'udhu billahi min shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to our program Like Muhammad with me, Javed Akberi. Well, in this episode, we are going to discuss the Holy Prophet of Islam's conduct and lifestyle, or his seerah, regarding violence. Violence has, gained tremendous usage in the language of the media, and also people wonder as to what the position of Islam is and what the position of the Holy Prophet of Islam is towards violence. And of course, in recent times, some Islamic factions have taken, gone to extremes, which is why a lot of people speak to know whether this is the exact position of Islam or not. And these factions and these, extremist groups have taken, for example, Tawheed as a pretext to carry out extreme measures such as mass murder and severe repression, killing, and so on and so forth. And of course, in justifying their actions, they have cited the example of the Muslims of the past and the companions of the Prophet, and they believe that their deeds are nothing but the continuation of the policies adopted by those, predecessors. And that's why these people are called Salafis. These people are known for their going back towards the age of the Prophet. And then, of course, in their theological disputes and polemical debates, they present their arguments, which is clear, which is very much clear, and they naively believe that they are going to be like those people, but in fact, they are not. In perpetrating their inhuman acts, these people and these groups, actually, including the Wahhabism and more recently the ISIS terrorist groups, of course, claim to base themselves solely on the words and deeds of the Holy Prophet of Islam and the pious predecessors. Now, we want to shed some light on the Prophet's conduct. And since these people put forth the example of the Prophet, the policies of the caliphs and the actions of their leaders, the leaders of the Islamic schools of thought, because we have many schools, like we have, for example, the Shafi'i, the Hanbali, the Malikis, and the Hanafites. Of course, these are the Sunni schools, but we have the Shia school on the other hand. And of course, these people try to explain their own actions with respect to Muslims who are, from their perspective, of course, mushrik, they are polytheists, and which is why they exercise some kind of extreme violence against them. They take recourse to excommunicating them, trying to exclude them, consider them as people who are out of the pale of Islam, out of the fold of Islam, and then unleash the most atrocious, the most brutal conducts and atrocities against them.
ربنا عليك قدرا يا إمام الأنبياء يا حبيبي يا محمد يا نبي سلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات الله عليك.
We conclude, brothers and sisters, that a proper study of the life and example of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, not only gives us definite criteria and principled proofs for a number of civil and legal courts, but also allows us to critic certain deviant ideologies. The example of the Prophet of Islam, who was a pious and, of course, the most pious man that humanity has so far seen, and whose words and deeds form the exact basis of the law, can be very much a source of authority. And we always look at the life of the Holy Prophet, at the Prophet's normative conduct as the example, as the true example of, you know, kindness, of benevolence, of generosity, of mercy and compassion. And we always aspire, in fact, to follow him as our role model. Now let's see the Prophet's seerah and conduct before the Hijrah. And that's something we need to discuss with you, of course. Brothers and sisters, one of the most tragic periods of the life of the Holy Prophet began on the day on which he broke the seal of silence. He stopped being silent, and the elders of Quraysh, you know, lost all hope of, you know, accepting their, you know, offers in view of his well-known words, because the Prophet of Islam, when the Quraysh did everything they could to convince the Prophet of Islam to stop promoting and propagating his religion and spreading the word of God, because the Quraysh wanted to keep worshipping and glorifying their own statues, handmade statues, and they wanted to continue with their idolatry. But the Prophet of Islam actually disappointed them. The Quraysh, on the other hand, lost all hope of convincing the Prophet. And the Prophet clearly and loudly said, "By Allah, even if you place the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand, so that I may abandon my call, I will not rest until Allah makes my religion prevail or I lay down my life for its sake." So this is the word of the Prophet of Islam. And
my heart is so full of longing. I wish to be close to my beloved. I dream to walk in the streets of Medina and to quench the thirst of my spirit by visiting you, O Muhammad.
The Quraysh and the pagans, the infidels of Mecca, started to lose hope of convincing the Prophet, of stopping the Prophet. During all the encounters with the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Quraysh preserved the Prophet's respect. But when they saw that all their conciliation efforts and all their conciliation offers actually had failed, they were compelled to change the course of their thinking and to stop and forestall the expansion of Islam at all costs and to utilize all means for this purpose. That's what they actually did. Hence, the Council of Quraysh decided unanimously to practice ridicule, to torture the Prophet, to intimidate the Prophet, to restrain the Prophet from pursuing his objectives. And the Quraysh did not, leave any stone unturned to torment the Prophet. But what was the Prophet's reaction and how did he react towards the Quraysh? That's something we need to discuss, inshallah, in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad did.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.